iteration of the Buddha's teachings. The problem was defined as suffering. All conditioned existence is suffering. This is a terrible situation, and there's got to be a way out of it. So the Buddha said there is. There is a way out of it. There is a way to end suffering. So in the earliest iteration of the teachings, this was the idea that one notices the pervasiveness of suffering. All kinds of suffering, not only the suffering that looks like suffering, but even the suffering that doesn't look like suffering and doesn't even necessarily feel like suffering is actually suffering when you look closely. So we need a path that will help us to see this point, confront it directly, and overcome the suffering. And so the goal is peace, overcoming suffering. Nirvana means to blow out like a candle, to blow out the flame of the passions of suffering and have some peace. But religious people are always thinking and, you know, discussing and experiencing and seeing things in a new way. So as time went by, many of the Buddhist pundits said, well, let's think about this again. It turns out that when we try to escape from the suffering, a lot of times we're making the suffering worse. So maybe the truth is that what the Buddha really meant was that the way to end suffering is not to eliminate it, wipe it out, as it seems to be the case. The way to really overcome suffering is to understand suffering and embrace it fully. And that is putting an end to suffering. And so the goal of the practice changed as time went on from ending suffering for oneself by eliminating suffering to understanding the suffering and embracing it as a way of finding a deeper peace. And this view of the path required and implied a deep connection to others. Because a true understanding of suffering and its root shows us that the cause of our suffering is our self-centeredness, our self-focus. And when we understand that there's no way we could be here at all without others, there's no way we could live even for a minute without others, that in our deepest sense of identity, we are others and others are us. To release ourselves to love and compassion is the way to find peace and end suffering. It's not a matter of personal peace. There's no such thing as personal peace. There's only connection to one another. That's peace. So this was a whole new view of the path. And the ideal changed from becoming an arhat or a Buddha who had a personal salvation to being a bodhisattva, who was dedicated to loving others, identifying with others, benefiting others. So instead of having a goal of no more rebirths into the realm of suffering, the goal became endless rebirths, but not rebirth from unfinished business of suffering that propelled us on and on and on into more and more birth, but birth intentionally accomplished with the motivation of love. So a bodhisattva vows to be reborn again and again and again for the purpose of loving and benefiting others. It's a radically different view of the same path. Actually, the difference between these two views is very much analogous to the difference between early Judaism and rabbinical Judaism and Christianity, which also made a radical interpretation, reinterpretation of the same scriptures. Didn't reject them, but said, there's a new way to understand this and look at it. And this actually happened around the same time that this same thing was happening in Buddhism. It's hard to believe that there wasn't mutual influence here. So, the Bodhisattva path, a path of seeing through our narrow self-concern, seeing through the narrowness of our very strong concepts of ourselves as isolated, atomized individuals, to a sense of understanding ourselves as being radically connected to, in a warm, face-to-face way, one another. Developing in our hearts a commitment to love and care and act on behalf of others. And that's the path. That's the point of our meditation practice. That's the liberation that we seek. And everything we do in spiritual practice is for that purpose. And that's the way that we ourselves can be happy and get unhooked from our addiction to our own suffering by seeing past ourselves. So bodhisattvas are people who, and in the scriptures, in the Mahayana scriptures, which was a bursting out of religious poetry and enthusiasm, huge numbers of Mahayana texts were composed over a number of centuries in this spirit. They usually depict sort of semi-mythical beings called bodhisattvas, who have an endless capacity to make extravagant vows, to do all kinds of things on behalf of others forever and ever and ever, and to do all kinds of heroic practices dedicated to the benefit of others over a long period of time. So the whole path of bodhisattvas became little by little defined through these scriptures over the generations. And the key moment in the career of a bodhisattva is the moment when the being suddenly realizes that this is the heart's desire, that what we all want, what I want as a bodhisattva, is to commit myself completely to my own awakening, which is the awakening of all others, which is altruism and love and compassion. That moment dawns on me. It's kind of like a conversion moment. I realize that this effort to seek my own benefit will never work, will never pay off, and it's foolish to begin with. That the only way that I could live, the only thing that makes sense as a life, is to be concerned for others, to love others, and to do everything that I do, even the things that apparently have nothing to do with others, for others and with others, everything that I do. So, you know, in Zen practice we say, you know, clean out your bowls after you eat for all sentient beings. Everything you do, dedicate to others with that spirit, with that heart. Help others directly. But even when you don't seem to be helping others directly, have a heart to be helping others in everything you do. So this moment of realizing this and dedicating oneself fully to this is called bodhicitta, the thought of awakening. And the thought of awakening is inherently an altruistic thought, a thought of benefiting others. So anyway, I'm telling you all this because that's background to this text that I want to talk about in detail over this weekend. Because it's a text for generating and turning us in the direction of bodhicitta, of this conviction, this thought that what we really, the only thing that really we can really do is work to benefit others, and that's our practice. So the text is called Training in Compassion. In the version that was published by Shambhala, the title is Training in Compassion, Zen Teachings on the Practice of Lojong, based on an original Indo-Tibetan text called Seven Points of Mind Training. And in a little while, I'll go into briefly the seven points, and we'll spend our time zeroing in on certain aspects. We can't do all of it, but we'll zero in on certain aspects of it. But the text begins with a powerful meditation on our motivation for practicing. I find that, you know, realistically speaking, just practically speaking, a lot of people are interested to come and do meditation practice for a whole variety of reasons. You know, maybe it will help with my anxiety. I have a friend who does it. She thinks it's a good idea. Maybe I should join her. Very seldom it's, I want to save all sentient beings and become a Buddhist. Very few people have that idea. So realistically, we have all kinds of not necessarily deeply considered motivations for coming to do the practice. And the truth of the matter is that as we continue with the practice, if we do, and we continue to meditate, we will not be able to prevent ourselves from having a deeper look at what is it that actually brought us in the first place. You know, maybe I thought it was this, but maybe it was really that. And usually that happens as we go along. We become clear about our motivation, and if we don't, we usually don't continue. In other words, if we're not clear about the motivation and it's just kind of a nice thing to do, well, it's not that worthwhile. You know, this is not that much fun, really. If it's just kind of a nice thing to do, there are a lot of nicer things to do, probably, you know, than sit in silence, maybe with a sore back for 48 hours or a week or a month. So, it does, you know, our first motivation doesn't take us very far. Well, this text proposes a rather specific guided meditation on our motivation. And that's the beginning. So I thought that would be a good place to start. So I'd like to do this, if you're willing. We do a guided meditation practice. I don't know how long it takes, a little while. And there are four traditional points to consider. So the way that we can do this is we can start, you know, I'll ring the bell for meditation, and we can have a few minutes of silence to bring ourselves back to our breath and our body. And then I'll do a little roll down on the bell like this. And then one by one, while we're meditating, I'll go through the traditional reflections on each of these four points. And I'll do it slowly so that you can just listen. But don't just listen to my words, also listen to your own heart and see what you're actually feeling as you reflect on these things. And it's very important here, very important, to be honest. I think the greatest kind of misunderstanding about spiritual practice is that it sounds like a whole series of things we should be doing and we should be feeling. So spiritual practice ends up doing violence to our hearts when we're actually not feeling and doing the things we should be feeling and doing. And then we try not to admit that to ourselves, or somehow we berate ourselves for not having the proper attitudes. So let's not do that. Let's actually pay attention to what really is going on. For example, if I'm saying blah, 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 this and this and this, and you're saying inside, boy, do I hate that. I do not agree with that. That is, in fact, that's scary, disturbing, and just wrong. If that's the way you feel, you should pay attention to that. Don't say, oh my God, what's going on? I came here and I don't agree with it. No, that's very important for you to pay attention to what's actually going on. This is the main thing, is to be honest with what's going on. So while I'm doing the words, you just see what's happening inside. And just, you don't need to argue with yourself, just pay attention to yourself. Okay? And at the end of each point, I'll do another little roll down on the bell, and then I'll go on to the next one. And we'll go through all of the 4 points, and you'll see what you're feeling. And then, just so you know in advance, then what we'll do is I'm going to ask everybody to find one person to talk to, and I'm going to ask you to say what you're feeling now, after you've been through this meditation, as honestly as you can, as honestly as you feel comfortable with, to say, this is what I feel, this is how it struck me, and then listen to the other person. You'll each get a chance to talk, and that's a very important part. It's amazing how important it is to vocalize, to say what's going on with you. Not just sit and listen, but to be able to say, this is how it is for me. So I'll give some instructions about how we'll structure that conversation, but just so you know, we'll do that. That doesn't mean you have to remember everything that, you know, comes into your mind, so you can report it to the other person. I'm not asking you to do that. I'm just asking you to say how you're feeling at that moment. Okay? So we're ready for that? They'll begin by establishing awareness of the body, noticing how you're sitting, lifting up your upper torso, the back of the head, pressed up toward the sky, chin tucked in, shoulders back, chest open, heart open, noticing your shoulders, your arms, your hands, returning your awareness to this present moment of being alive with the body, and with the breathing. Feeling the breath in, feeling the breath out. Bringing awareness to each and every breath. gathering your awareness here, bringing calmness and spaciousness to your mind and heart through awareness of the body and breath. The first reflection. The rarity and the preciousness of your human life. There are what, maybe 7 billion human beings on the planet, so it may seem as if a human being is not a rare commodity. But if you take the total number of beings on the planet, the creatures under the sea, in the air, on the land, the insects, the bacteria, there are more bacteria living in our bodies than there are cells in our bodies. So if you consider the total number of living beings on the planet, truly it is rare find a human being. And if you consider that this is just one small planet in a virtually endless series of galaxies with endless space between, you realize how rare, how unlikely it is to find a human being. So human life really is rare, precious, sacred. A living human body with its capacities and capabilities of mind and thought and language and imagination emotion, consciousness risen to the point where there is identity and value and thought and beauty and autonomous choice. This is dear beyond compare. And you have received this rare and precious gift of a human lifetime, a human body, a human heart, a human mind. Whatever limitations you may think you have, whatever longing or unfulfilled promise, it's very small compared to this immense gift that you have already received. To live a human life is an unbelievable blessing, rare and precious in all the universe. And without any particular effort on your part, you have received this gift. How often do you remember? And are you living a life that honors the gift you've been given? Are you living your life mindful of the highest of human purposes? This is the first thing to consider. The second point. Now, the absolute inevitability of death. The absolute inevitability of death. Of course, we all understand this one. Probably most of us don't remember the first time that we learned that everyone, without exception, dies. Maybe it was such a traumatic piece of knowledge that we forgot about it. And the truth is, we do forget about it, even though we know intellectually it's true. If you notice the way you live every day, you live your days as if you would never die. In a way, none of us really believe that we will die. We believe in some way we will be the sole exception to the otherwise general rule. But we know it's true. We will die. We've seen friends and relatives pass on. And if we really paid attention, we would recognize that death is the most important factor of every single moment of our lives. It's not just something for later. Because it's thanks to death that we can cross over from one moment to the next. If this moment doesn't die, completely disappearing, the next moment can't come. So loss and death are facts of every moment. This is what impermanence means. But one day, a moment will come exactly like all the others, but different in one respect. It will not be succeeded by another moment of your life. People will then say, he or she has died. This is very real. And the thing about this moment that's the most difficult thing of all is that you don't know when it's coming. Most of us think, well, I know when it's coming, later. Not now, later. When I'm old. And if you're old now, when I'm older. Death comes in extreme old age. Extreme old age. And since now we're not that old, it isn't really a problem. But of course, death doesn't come in extreme old age. Death comes when it feels like it. And nobody knows when. Young people die. Children die. Middle-aged people die. We know this. And even if death does come in extreme old age, extreme old age comes a lot more quickly than you thought. Most of us here can appreciate the fact that we were quite young. We blinked our eyes 3 or 4 times, and we're not young anymore. How did that happen? How did those decades fly by all of a sudden? Time is not what is measured by clocks or calendars. Clocks and calendars are practical conveniences. Time is life. Time is lived time. The only time that matters is lived time. And as we all have experienced, the older you get, the faster time is going. When you were in the third grade and the summer vacation came, it was such a long period of time. It was as if school would never, ever start again. You couldn't even imagine that far into the future. And the summer did last a really, really, really long time, didn't it? So many things happened in the summer. And by the time the fall came around, it was like another lifetime. Now the summer goes by in 5 minutes. Now if someone says to you, well, this is difficult, but you'll only have to do it for 5 years. You say, oh, well, 5 years, that's nothing. No problem. I can do that for 5 years or 2 years. In other words, time is actually speeding up. Time does speed up with the accumulation of age and lived experience. So if you're 30 and you say, well, I expect to live to 90, so my life is one-third over, you're miscalculating. If you're 30, your life is maybe 80% gone. If you're 50, 60, it's true. There's not that much time left for any of us. This is a problem. It's a problem not later, but now. In other words, we are all living in the midst of a very urgent situation. In Zen, we have a ceremony to mark the end of every week. And we chant in the ceremony, practice as if your hair was on fire. Because it is. There is no time to waste. When are you going to clarify your life's path and your life's purpose, if not now? The inevitability of death and the scarcity of time is the second point to think about if we want to develop a real motivation to practice and change our life. The third point, the awesome and indelible power of our actions. In Buddhism, this is called karma, which is not something mystical or fatalistic. It simply means that actions produce results. They have effects. every action, large and small, every thought, every word, every deed, every gesture has a consequence. And we will never know the measure of these consequences as they ripple through the world, although they are extensive and powerful. Without our necessarily knowing it, without our necessarily paying attention to it, every single moment of our lives up to this moment right now, we have been affecting the world in some subtle yet real way. Every moment we have been participating in creating the world that now exists for ourselves and others. And everything in our life is and has always been effective and important. Everything matters. There is no such thing as a trivial, throwaway moment. Most of us think of ourselves as rather inconsequential, powerless people. Maybe we think other people have power. The president has power. The mayor has power. The great scientist has power. The pop star is an important person. The movie star is an important person. The Buddhist master is an important person. We are not so important. This is not the case. The actions, thoughts, and words of each one of us are important. All of us together are making this world. We are all empowered, we are all responsible. There's no place to hide. So we have to ask ourselves, how am I living? What kinds of thoughts do I cultivate? What kinds of actions am I taking? Am I an active force for good in the world? Or am I just another person doing nothing to help and therefore making things worse? The awesome and indelible power of every word, deed, and thought. That's the third point to consider. The fourth point is the inescapability of suffering. Although this is not something we enjoy thinking about, it seems that sorrow and suffering are an inevitable part of any human life. Even the happiest life has its share of sorrow and suffering. There's the suffering of loss, disappointment, disrespect, the suffering of physical pain, illness, old age, the suffering of broken relationships, the suffering of wanting something badly and never being able to have it, the suffering of not wanting something and being stuck with it for a long time. The everyday suffering of painful, afflictive emotions like jealousy, grief, anger, hatred, confusion, anguish, all kinds of emotions that cause us suffering. We can't hold on to anything that we've got and we know it. All this is part of life. No one could avoid it. Given that this is so, how could we not take our lives in hand and make a serious effort to develop wisdom, compassion, and resilience so that we can prepare our minds and hearts for the inevitable suffering that we're going to be facing someday and that we do face almost every day? We all take out insurance for our car. We figure something might happen. We're prepared. We take out insurance for our home in case something happens. We go to the doctor regularly because we want to protect our health. Why then would we not think to guard and strengthen our mind and heart to cope with the suffering that certainly will be coming in some measure at some time? How did we think we could get away without doing this all this time? The rarity and preciousness of human life, the inevitability of death, the awesome and indelible power of all our actions, the inescapability of suffering.
Thank you.